the first episode of Season 2 of The Breach, your deep dive into authoritarianism and corruption in the era of Trump. I'm your host, Lindsay Beierstein. And before we get underway, I want to take a sec to congratulate Nora Hurley, our producer, on her recent move from Buffalo to New York City. The so-called fake news media is Trump's evergreen excuse for his unpopularity. As his approval rating trends downward, he swings harder and harder against the press, at home and overseas. The president's top spokespeople endlessly remind us that anyone who criticizes the president will be hit back 10 times harder, which is slowly normalizing the authoritarian idea that the president punishes his critics. Our guest today is historian Rick Perlstein, the author of several celebrated books on the conservative movement, including Nixonland and The Invisible Bridge. He's here today to compare Richard Nixon's relationship to the media with Donald Trump's. Rick argues that Trump is a creature of the Republican Party that Richard Nixon created. Rick, welcome to the program.
Pleasure to be back.
It's become almost a truism that Trump's dealings with the media are Nixonian. What do people mean by that?
Right. Richard Nixon was really the first modern American politician to frame the press as, in Trump's terms, an enemy of the people. You know, he didn't use those terms publicly. Privately, of course, he did even worse, but he might as well have, right? And the idea that, well, this is how his vice president put it in a very famous speech in 1969. That's kind of a difference between Trump and Nixon. Nixon kind of sent out surrogates to do the really nasty stuff publicly. You know, it was a real big watershed in November of 1969 when Richard Nixon was so angry at all three networks for doing immediate response to a big Vietnam speech he did in November of 1969. That was the famous silent majority speech that he just decided it was time to go nuclear. And it was actually Pat Buchanan's idea to send out Spiro Agnew, who was this vice president who really had no public profile whatsoever until this point. But he gave this speech that basically got covered live. He guilted the White House guilted all three networks into covering it live, right? Mm-hmm. So using that sort of manipulation of the press in order to attack the press. And he criticized, and I'm quoting here, a small band of network commentators and self-appointed analysts, the majority of whom expressed in one way or another their hostility to what he had to say. It was obvious that their minds were made up in advance, which, of course, wasn't obvious. Now I want to make myself perfectly clear. I'm not asking for government censorship or any other kind of censorship. I'm asking whether a form of censorship already exists when the news that 40 million Americans receive each night is determined by a handful of men responsible only to their corporate employers and is filtered through a handful of commentators who admit to their own set of biases. So this was, you know, kind of brewing for a long time. You know, the coverage of the riots at the Democratic convention the previous summer, you know, were criticized in much the same terms. But wasn't that a clever formulation, right?
That it's there's certainly a grain of truth in it, that there really is a corporate elite and it is very cozy with power brokers.
Right. And, you know, this is, again, the big difference between how the Nixon White House did things and the Trump White House did things was the Nixon White House was able to frame things that just got so much more leverage from this kind of anger. But with Richard Nixon, of course, it goes back quite a bit further than that. He was always angry that this so-called media elite sided with Alger Hiss, right, who was the very distinguished State Department official who was accused of being a communist in the 1940s. And Richard Nixon, as a member of the House Un-American Activities Committee, investigated him, eventually got him to commit perjury. Remember, the perjury trap is always a big one. And so the Hiss Chambers case was kind of like the big political melodrama of the 1940s. And he had decided way back then that the liberals and the press and the liberals in the press and the press who were liberal would never forgive him for that. And, you know, even though, you know, he, in a lot of ways, throughout his career, was a media darling, certainly in the pages of the Los Angeles Times, which was a very powerful newspaper in Southern California where he came up. But in 1962, when he lost the governor's race, they covered him in a much more objective way. You know, they covered him basically fairly instead of leaning on the scales in his favor. And he was so disillusioned by this that he gave a very famous speech after he lost in 1962. He was drunk. He had just, you know, lost the governor's race 2 years after losing the presidential race. And his press secretary begged him to go down and at least give some kind of concession statement, which is supposed to be gracious. But instead, he very famously said, "You won't have Nixon to kick around anymore because, gentlemen, this is my last press conference. I hope the press recognize that they have a right and responsibility. If they're against the candidate, give him the shaft," which was very foul stuff for the time. But also recognize if they give him the shaft, put one lonely reporter on the campaign who will report what the candidate says now and then. So, you know, he was onto something, right? He was onto something that a lot of people in the 1960s, in which, you know, the fashionable way the wind was blowing was in the direction of these sort of basically movements of liberation that in a lot of ways were challenging the ways of thinking of middle America, and that the press seemed to be on the side of these liberation movements, which was very alienating for the people that Richard Nixon labeled the silent majority, who really felt condescended to, that their values were not considered moral anymore, that the moral people were the people who were, you know, causing these disruptions. So he had something very potent. And of course, he wasn't the only person during this period who was making these gestures, but he was the best and he was the most effective, and he influenced basically every conservative politician since.
And it is interesting how that kind of rhetoric of condescension comes in. It's so frustrating and potent because there are fundamental moral disagreements in our society, and yet one side has decided that criticism is automatically condescending.
Right. And in a way, this gets to some very kind of basic, kind of almost cognitively ingrained ways of thinking that determine whether you're a left-wing person or a right-wing person, right? I mean, if the press in an enlightenment-based society is all about telling truth to power, it's a disruptive force, right? And if you're a person who, you know, values stability over a disruption, then you're going to feel condescended to by people who think that your very longing for stability is somehow morally suspect.
But how do we bring that out into a healthier kind of dialogue in which people can say, well, I value stability and that's a thing and I'm prepared to argue for it and you're going to argue for a change in confrontation and we can actually exchange ideas productively instead of them feeling like they're being condescended to?
Well, I think in a sense, it's structurally very difficult, if not impossible, for people who basically believe, you know, all is well in the world and have a Panglossian view of certainly America to be thinking about a mode of citizenship and patriotism, which demands more accountability for America. And to me, the lesson for journalists, for reporters, for commentators is, as I always put it, you know, tell the truth as you see it, without fear or favor, and devil take the hindmost, and basically put up the fact that there's really no way that if you're doing your job right, you're not going to get that charge hurled at you, and not to be, you know, not to negotiate with yourself and not to be intimidated by that fact, that that's just a natural part of being a truth teller, you know, and that truth telling in that sense is an enlightenment value that will always be a challenging thing to people whose values are different than the Enlightenment.
One of the really disturbing things about Trump is that he seems to have these sort of paramilitaries online and actual budding paramilitaries in the streets to enforce his will against journalists and anybody else who crosses him. Did Nixon have those kinds of rank and file operatives out in the world enforcing his will, or is this a new development?
No, he actually did have basically thugs doing that kind of intimidation for him, whether it was a physical intimidation in the case of there was recently a memo that was kind of brought to prominence. I think it might have been discovered in the archives, but it didn't basically say anything that we didn't already know, that he was sending out people to rough up people like Daniel Ellsberg, who, you know, wasn't necessarily a journalist, but he was persona non grata because he had, you know, leaked the Pentagon Papers to journalists.
He was journalist adjacent.
Right. He was journalist adjacent. So, you know, in that case, you know, it was outright physical thuggery. But he also, Richard Nixon, had a political enforcer named Chuck Colson, who was a really nasty guy. He said he would run over his own grandmother to reelect Richard Nixon. I mean, that's a quote, who was doing things like showing up in the offices of William Paley, who was the CEO of CBS, and basically intimidating him with the power of the White House. He was going to people like Katharine Graham, who was the publisher of the Washington Post, and threatening the Post with losing their licenses, which were very lucrative, to operate local television stations if they didn't play ball. And very early in the presidential term of Richard Nixon in 1969, one of his then White House officials, who later became a re-election campaign official who went to jail, Jeb Stuart Magruder, for Watergate, wrote a very detailed memo. It's called the Shotgun and Rifle Memo, in which he laid out basically 12 ways to use the power of the executive branch to intimidate the press. And we had Roger Ailes, who also was a Nixon operative, who was talking about coming up with some sort of independent media infrastructure that was loyal to the White House. And we had Patrick Buchanan, right, who's been playing this game for a very, very long time. And of course, started his career as a journalist, as an editorial writer, although one who was also a conduit for smears from J. Edgar Hoover against people like Martin Luther King. Pat Buchanan, you know, was talking about the same thing. We need to come up with our own think tanks. We need to come up with our own media institutions. So whether it was physical intimidation, which we see evidence of from the Nixon White House, or call it bureaucratic or legal intimidation, this was serious business, and it wasn't invented by Donald J. Trump.
And then you've got Roger Stone, the resident chaos demon who cut his teeth in the Nixon era and is still sowing that kind of chaos today.
That's right. He came out of that world, and his introduction to Republican politics was a dirty trick on behalf of the Nixon reelection campaign in the New Hampshire primary. And people like that were not anathema to the Republican firmament. They rose in the Republican firmament. Roger Stone was running California for Ronald Reagan's presidential campaign in 1976.
It's interesting how the New York Times just reported recently that unnamed White House aides are already threatening to thwart Time Warner, which is CNN's parent company's merger with AT&T, if CNN keeps giving them unfavorable coverage.
Right, and that's the Nixon playbook, right? That's the shotgun and the rifle. When Jeb Magruder was talking about, he said we're basically using a shotgun against the press, which means, you know, kind of like high level sort of retail attacks on the press, but we should be using a rifle. He meant we need to use these pinprick intimidation tactics, and one of them was, you know, threatening the business interests of the people who own the media.
Which does seem a lot more efficient, because if there were just one of these big regulatory cases where the DOJ stepped in and just made a lot of trouble, you know, cost them a few $100,000, the companies involved, there would be a huge chilling effect rippling all over the media food chain.
Well, isn't that how mafias always operate, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, there are terrorists. You know, the idea is that you create examples, right? As public as possible. You know, you make sure that they die in the street.
Have you felt just in the last couple weeks that the pitch of Trump's hostility towards the media has increased dramatically? I mean, it was always bad from the very beginning of his career as a casino magnate, even. And as a candidate, it was bad. But it seems like there's been a kind of inflection point after the fake news gif that Trump circulated, where it's just become fever pitched and really scary.
Right. And that's true. But let me sort of, before addressing that, let me like actually rewind a little bit and make the same point about Trump that I made about Richard Nixon, that these people are products of the very media they attack. So in Trump's case, obviously, you know, his ability to kind of get in the media and use it as a lever for his own sense of himself is absolutely crucial to his rise. And when it comes to the presidential campaign, without CNN chasing after ratings by basically becoming Trump TV during the 2016 presidential election, it's inconceivable he'd be president. Just like it's inconceivable that Richard Nixon ever would have became a senator in California or a congressman before that without the Los Angeles Times. So it's really the withdrawal of consent from the media that freaks these people out rather than the media as such.
So you think that Trump is basically sort of a spurned lover of CNN,
A spurned lover of CNN. Yeah, exactly.
The New York Times never gave him that kind of deference.
Right. And now he's, an abusive lover. Right. the gif with CNN, which, justifiably people are horrified by, especially since, it really seems like, one of his ugliest cretins in the White House, Dan Scavino, the head of social media, who, used to be Trump's caddy, seems to troll Reddit, troll in the sense of trawling, trolls for trolls, Reddit to find, white supremacist lunacy in order to kind of pass on to the president. The way this kind of CNN video went down really is a message from, as they say, the highest levels, that it's open season on the media, not just in terms of criticism, but possibly onto physical abuse. And yeah, that does seem to be a watershed. And, all of us who work in this field, being critical of Trump or even objective about Trump, know what it's like to have this invective hurled at us. And that's the challenge. And, I don't want to be a whiner, but it really makes me think twice about what I write, which is awful and horrifying, and really makes me glad that I, live in a building that has, a gate around it, for the sake of my family. It's real. People have been, who's the guy who wrote recently on a series of posts on Twitter about what happened to him?
I was just going to ask you about that Jared Yates Sexton.
Yeah. How did that go down? Remind me.
Oh, it was just awful. He's got a piece in Politico that just went up yesterday about the reaction. So basically he said, hey, Hans Asso Solo, the guy who was the author of that GIF, he just noticed that, hey, he's got a bunch of hardcore anti-Semitic things in his back catalog, essentially. Right. He didn't do anything. It wasn't a particular expose or anything that was in dispute. Right. It's like this same guy, the same poster, the same account, created a bunch of overtly anti-Semitic stuff. And then a bunch of anti-Semites descended on him and abused him in extremely anti-Semitic terms because they were angry that they mentioned that their guy was an anti-Semite, which I'm still trying to wrap my mind around.
Well, it's not about logic. It's about domination. Right. So this guy's an enemy. So he's going to be treated like an enemy. And, like I say, going back to these Enlightenment values, the idea is there's a neutral field, the Republic of Letters, in which, all the arguments are entertained for this, basically on their merits. That's the ideal, unattached to the authority of the person who makes them. But, if you're saying this person is hurting my guy, and I don't care if it's true or not, I'm going to hurt you for hurting me. That's a different set of values that are totally antithetical to the Enlightened values that, basically modern journalism is founded upon.
And it's funny because the term fake news itself has become kind of a Rovian attack on the opponent's strengths. Because remember, around the time of the election, the left and the center were very concerned about out-and-out frauds and fabrications from Moldovan teenagers and Pizzagate and that kind of stuff being circulated as fake news and complained about it and the influence that it might have had on throwing the election. And then Trump turned around and used fake news to apply to stuff that's unquestionably true, that even... And his partisans are like, nobody's denying that Hans Asso Solo created anti-Semitic GIFs. Right. And yet that's called fake news.
Yes. And that not even getting to the issue of collusion between Putin and Trump, that seems to be one of the masterful things that the Kremlin does. The disinformation is all about dissolving any neutral standpoint by which truth can be evaluated. Right. By hijacking the very terms of description. Right. Fake news equals bad.
So people don't feel safe anywhere.
Feel safe. People don't feel safe in terms of
asserting
ontologically safe,
physically safe or ontologically safe. But nothing is safe to assert or point to or conjecture.
Right. And, as someone who reads a lot of kind of old media. One of the most enriching civic experiences I've had this year is reading Sidney Blumenthal's so far two volumes, eventually four volume biography of Abraham Lincoln. And interestingly enough, the press then was avowedly partisan. All newspapers were organs of political parties. But at the same time, if you could beat someone in a debate using the techniques of rhetoric and using their own words against them, or getting to admit they were wrong, or humiliating them by catching them in contradictions, they kind of stayed beat. I mean, there was that kind of discourse ethics in place, that people, words were very important. They were very sacred. Abraham Lincoln certainly treated language almost like a religion, and truth and falsehood were values, even in a highly partisan era, that could be agreed upon in a way that has become less possible in an era, ironically, in which we don't have partisan media. At least, you know, the mainstream media is not explicitly partisan, but we still, you know, basically can't stage a debate in which someone who objectively and logically loses can count themselves as a loser and feel shame for that. And by shame, I mean when you know, like Abraham Lincoln or someone else beat someone in a platform debate, you'd see them crying. You know, they would almost literally be retreating with their tail between their legs. But there's so much shamefulness among, you know, the people who think like, you know, the Roger Stones of the world or Donald Trump, that, you know, truth among Trumpies counts for nothing.
And what does that mean if we can't even discuss things in logical ways anymore? What's left in terms of people who disagree with each other and how they're going to deal with that?
Well, were it the case that we can't agree on anything, then that would be an apocalyptic situation. But I don't think we're quite there yet. You know, it was very interesting to see a conspiracy committed against the truth in 2002 and 2003. By the Bush White House. We remember how Dick Cheney would make something up about the intelligence involving Iraq's weapons of mass destruction. He would feed it to Judith Miller at the New York Times. It would be printed in the New York Times, and then he'd go on the Sunday show saying, this is true because it was in the New York Times. This was the kind of lying that got us into the war in Iraq. But we still all understand that, you know, the Bush administration lied us into war, and the Iraq war was a disaster. That's pretty much, I think, a consensus of most of society. So truth can still out, right? I think that shows with Donald Trump's approval ratings. That shows with the fact that people overwhelmingly say Donald Trump should stop using Twitter, which is his, you know, main vector for lies.
And epistemic chaos generally.
Yeah, I think in a lot of ways, Twitter, the medium is the message. When you have this mode of communication in which, you know, really the only way to get across a message is to blurt, it creates a discourse situation made up of blurts, right? And it's just a machine for miscommunication, for misunderstanding, for a kind of gladiatorial combat situation with discourse. So yeah, in a lot of ways, the medium is the message, but we also have, people like, you know, you, who do the kind of stuff that you do that are flourishing in this kind of long form stuff. And we have the, you know, kind of indivisible sort of resistance generally that is getting out very powerful messages, you know, using the disintermediated tools of, you know, videos of, you know, confrontations between congressmen and their constituents. So, you know, we're not that
bad yet. Speaking the old-fashioned language of vote counting and policy proposals and very empirically based stuff. I mean, they're doing incredibly well. How many groups do they have? 5,000 or something like that nationwide?
Right. You know, and I'd compare that to the Watergate situation where people became very civically engaged. You know, I mean, there was an equal and opposite or even greater reaction to the action by Richard Nixon. People were disgusted and they did something about it. And for a while, and maybe this will happen, you know, post-Trump, the forces of deception were really knocked back on their heels. I mean, if you look at the world of 1974, 1975, 1976, you have, you know, the Church Committee hearings in the Senate, which just completely blew the lid off the abuses and the deceptions of the Intelligence Committee. You know, you had campaign finance reform. You had a real culture of investigative journalism. So, you know, I don't think that, you know, suddenly we're kind of holding up our hands in surrender and defeat, you know. I don't think the situation for communication generally is in fact a chaotic one. I think it's a war of position, and we're not doing all that bad.
Do you think that Trump's self-isolation from the truth and the facts could ultimately be his downfall? I mean, his attacks against the media are basically a way of insulating himself from all criticism and all actual real information and data from the world that he doesn't like. How sustainable is that when you're governing a country?
That's a really important point, right? In order to convince someone, you have to kind of start with a ground, a set of axioms that they can buy. And if you can't kind of buy the axioms on which he's, you know, basically basing his lies upon, then, you know, you really can't go along with what he's saying. And you know, that's kind of a long-term process, but as, you know, the kind of salvation that he promises to deliver to his constituents, you know, isn't delivered, you know, he becomes more and more harder to trust. And I think we really are seeing that in the polls. When we see, you know, 51% in the latest polls of white working class voters disapproving of Trump, you know, when we see his hard, you know, kind of hardcore support going down in the polls, you know, I think that a lot of that, you're right, does come from the fact that he's in a very visceral sense out of touch from reality. Right. And he can't even kind of find axioms upon which to build something that people can believe. Right. He can say, you know, fake news when people attack, say, him for lying about job statistics. But if you don't have a job, you know, Ronald Reagan had a great line about this. If your neighbor doesn't have a job, it's a recession. If you don't have a job, it's a depression. So, you know, that's a kind of truth that may have in the long term more blunt force impact than the kind of sketchy sort of Hall of Mirrors stuff that Trump is trading in.
One thing, though, that I find very dismaying is that the Republican establishment, particularly senators and congressmen, are not doing anything to check Trump yet in any serious way. They'll scold him for his manners on Twitter, and that seems to be about it.
Yeah. But by the same token, they have an axiom to build upon, and that's really their support in the polls, and they're losing that. So, yes, they're morally shameful, right? And this can't be blamed on Trump. This is a devolution in the Republican Party that, you know, dates back to Nixon. You know, in a lot of ways, the Republican Party is the party of Watergate and not the party of Goldwater. Goldwater, you know, kind of in this sense, being someone who really did shoot from the hip and was allergic to basically unplanned speech and deception. He was a pretty darn honest guy. He said what he thought, and that's why he lost in a landslide, right?
Yeah.
But, you know, when we get to the next generation of conservatives, and especially, you know, kind of the 1970s and the new right, which was involved in basically institution building around direct mail communication that was based on, you know, kind of sensationalist lies, you know, the liberal educrats are teaching their children that it's okay to be a cannibal and a wife swapper, you know, in order to kind of, you know, raise money for the, you know, National Conservative Political Action Committee. You know, that's a culture on the Republican side. And, you know, hopefully, if the fever ever breaks, it may be because basically Trump places too much stress on the system.
And it might also be that the limits of opportunism might elapse if he fails to bring both Obamacare repeal and tax reform, that Republicans may stop humoring him so much, even regardless of what's going on in the polls.
That's right. I mean, I think the cynicism of the Republican Party is, you know, they know, you know, every smart Republican elite conservative knows that what they're selling isn't popular and has never been popular. Right. I mean, that kind of like, you know, shredding of, you know, even kind of middle class, you know, sort of solid kind of entitlements, you know, there's no way they could sell that if they were just saying what they actually intended. So it's always been in the figure of either kind of gutter snipes or kind of Panglossian smiling optimists like Reagan or someone like Trump. That, you know, like they see as, you know, kind of a viable front man to kind of slip this in under the radar. And when they saw Trump, they're like, wow, here's this guy who can really distract them, you know, by flashing these shiny objects in front of, you know, the hoi polloi, while we kind of slip, you know, Obamacare repeal and tax repeal under the wire when they're not looking. And once that proves to come a cropper, I wonder how useful Trump will be to them. He basically didn't deliver what they thought they were buying.
But it does concern me that tribalism is so ascendant that it's not policy that people are voting for when they vote Republican, because when you actually poll people on the various sub-things that voting Republican entails, they have very weak or limited support. But what people are really buying, what people are really voting for, is the idea of being a tribe of white, patriarchal, domineering individuals.
Yeah, that's tricky. And of course, that goes way back in American history. But we've had periods of extreme political tribalism before. And one of the ways the Democrats have prevailed, although we can't be glib about this either, because a lot of that was backed by a lot of racism too, was basically we back this tribe, i.e. The New Deal Democrats, because they're the people who have given us kind of secure jobs and secure homes and protected us from the depredations of the workplace, right? And, you know, I'm not willing to kind of give up on that while we kind of struggle for sort of, you know, an anti-racist polity too.
That's all the time we have for today. Thank you so much for coming on the program.
Cheers. Be well.
You too. This week's recommended reading is the piece we talked about in the interview by Jared Yates Sexton entitled I Found Han Asshole Solo's Anti-Semitic Posts, and Then the Death Threat Started. You can check that out in Politico. It's part of a burgeoning genre of postmortems to right-wing media pylons of Trump critical journalists. It's notable not just for the volume and vitriol of the abuse heaped on Sexton personally, but for the globally anti-press ideology of his tormentors. Some call for an outright slaughter of journalists, or a journocost. Get it? Sexton even stumbled across a subreddit with thousands of members called Physical Removal that's dedicated to fantasies of removing journalists and leftists. Disturbing reading, but well worth your time. That's it for recommended reading. The Breach is produced by Rewire Radio. Our executive producer is Mark Folletti. Our theme music is Dark Alliance, performed by Darcy James Argue's Secret Society. And I'm your host, Lindsay Beierstein. Tweet your suggestions, comments, and questions to @Beierstein, Beyerstein on Twitter. See you next week.